This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Ramat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks to better understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea, or in this case, something quite contemporary, and we hope that it will shed light on the world around you. And what are we looking at today? We're looking at the Bird of Jannah. Now, that's something I actually haven't heard of until we decided that this was going to be the topic for today. And to help us with this is Ong Jo Lin. She is an independent curator, and you heard her several weeks ago talking about urban poverty and such. And Yana Rizal, she is a coordinator with Project Dialogue, something that Fuad, you are intimately involved in. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we have them to help us with this. Perhaps, Fuad, you could lay the foundations for this.
The Bird of Jannah is just one manifestation of a broader trend that's happening right now, which is that Malaysians are going to Syria, or privileged Muslims from even developed countries are doing the same in order to seek martyrdom, right? So, but what we can find in that phenomena are a whole range of other issues, right? A narrative of alienation from the modern world. The use of technology, the appeal of the visual spectacle, and also a very interesting aesthetic narrative. So when they talk about heaven, they're talking about rivers, they're talking about birds, they're talking about virgins and angels. So there's a lot going on here, and I felt that the lineup that we have today, you included, Sharad, can shed light on the many dimensions that we are going to discuss.
Thanks for including me, Fuad. Tell us first, who is the Bird of Jannah?
Well, the Bird of Jannah came to media spotlight in Malaysia because purportedly she's Malaysian. In fact, there's a screenshot showing that showing herself claiming to be Malaysian.
So this is a person's actual person.
She's
right?
A person, but runs a very active Tumblr account detailing her day-to-day activities in the Islamic State. She's 26 years old. She's a doctor, and she seems to be, in many ways, I would say, exposed
like
to modern life. Yeah, in many ways like us.
Yana, when did you first kind of chance upon the Bird of Jannah?
Actually, that was through a BuzzFeed link that we featured on Project Dialogue. So I found it very interesting because we're getting a first-hand account of what it's like to be in the Islamic State and to know that somebody from our own country purportedly actually going there and fighting the battle, you know, what her day-to-day life was and her journey into marriage and things like that. So
were you attracted or intrigued by the fact that she was first a woman and also a Muslim? Was that something that, you know, made you kind of sit back and think, oh, this is interesting? Because usually men, right? You know, we've had like former rock stars and all kinds of, you know, Mat Rempeh or not Mat Rempeh, like factory workers, whatever.
Yeah,
it
is. Yeah, there's a rock star, yeah. Yeah.
You know, people, yeah, men going off to war. Here is a woman going off to war. Was that something that piqued your interest?
Yeah, definitely piqued my interest, definitely intrigued me. I don't know so much if, you know, it attracted me to join her.
Oh,
definitely
no.
Not. But, you know, in terms of interest, definitely, yeah, because, you know, when you're talking about people who are going for martyrdom, usually, like as you said, it's usually a very male-dominated kind of discourse, but suddenly you have a woman going there. But then, to be fair, I think, you know, she didn't go there in to join the battlefield. She went there to offer services as a doctor. That was what I understood from her blog as well.
But women have always been called to war.
Yeah.
In Iran, women took arms and they fought alongside. Well, I hate to say alongside, but they fought, you know, together, everyone. It was everyone's war. And Industrial Revolution, you know, they called on women as well. That famous poster, we can do it, or is it you can do it? Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, women are not in the public sphere until when their labor is necessitated. And then, yes, but they are never fully emancipated still from the woman's destiny. So, you know, you get a paid wage labor outside of the home. You get to join the war. You get to be part of the humanitarian aid in a fight, like Bird of Jannah. She goes in as a doctor. But still, you know, in the domestic sphere, you're still bound by, you know, gender roles. You still don't have a certain subjectivity.
Yeah, but, you know, this is, I would disagree with you there, because in some ways it sounds like this is a woman who has volunteered for the battle. She seems to be full of agency. It seems to be that this is not somebody who's swept up in a mass recruitment or mobilization that's, you know, that's directed by the state with regard to this particular war. It's really her desire to be part of something.
I think there's a paradox to it. And that was the paradox that a lot of Shireen Nashat's work explores.
So, who's Shireen Nashat?
She is an Iranian-born artist, but working outside, in exile. Yeah, and a lot of her works that are known internationally are through photography, the medium of photography, and also film. Very recently, I think most of us may have heard of Women Without Men. So one of the early series was Women of Allah, where she herself posed in the photographs wearing the chador and with poems in Persian poems written on the parts of the body of a woman that would be allowed to be seen in public, you know, the palms of the hands, the face, and maybe the soles of the foot, I don't know, yeah. And she's talking about that paradox that, you know, when you look at images that were shown in the papers and documentaries back in the day, they looked very empowered. I mean, they were holding guns, rifles, right? And they were going into war. How, that's power. It's such pure, raw power. And yet, when you look into her work, the eyes and also just, unfortunately, the banner that is the veil in the woman's clothes, there's also this other thing that they're trapped in.
Okay, Fuad, I want to ask you if we could sort of step back from this, and before we get into the Bird of Jannah, just talk about the way in which this whole phenomenon of Malaysians going off to war, apparently not our war, you know, it's not a war that implicates the Malaysian state or anything like that directly. How do you think it's been framed? And how can we understand the framing of that particular phenomenon?
I think the problem is that it hasn't been framed well enough, or as well as it should, right? For one, what typically happens in media representations of these volunteers is a lot of moralizing. People are shocked. People are saying, oh, this is not what Islam teaches. This is not what Malaysians should do, blah, blah, blah. But in that, we miss a lot of the finer, more important points, such as the fact that, A, a lot of them are educated, right? So one of the recruiters is a professor at UM of the Islamic Studies Department. And this is a broader trend even from before. Like Nordin Maktab was a chemical engineer, right? And Bird of Jannah, if she is Malaysian, is a doctor. She's competent enough to be a doctor. She seems to be practicing. So the idea that they're ignorant doesn't quite explain really the phenomena, the desire, the drive. The second thing is also the psychological and imaginative dimension, right? The fact is, if you want to be a martyr, you can just go to 4 hours from here in southern Thailand, where there is also a war being fought along religious lines. You can go to Aceh, where there's already a Sharia state, right? You can
except
go to
they're not winning. That's right. In southern Thailand, they're not winning.
They're not winning, yeah.
Syria.
That's even all the more reason you should go. They're not winning. You can die much easier or something. I don't know. That's the logic, right? But I think that there is what we are seeing right now is a social media visual dimension whereby ISIS is putting out recruitment videos. It's using a Twitter feed. It's using, it's encouraging its members to update their Facebook accounts. So the interaction is virtual. And that tugs into a deeper psychic dimension where strings are being pulled beyond what we're familiar with when it comes to religious discourse.
Or they're also being paid a wage, I understand. And, Yana, one of the things that emerged soon after, you know, we had several months of discussion on ISIS is the fact that several women were going, and they were going to be, I don't know what the analogy was, like comfort women, women, yeah. Right? Yeah. There was also this case of a man who brought his wife and children, Singaporeans, to the battlefield. How do you think the framing of that work? I mean, were you disturbed by this media frenzy around so-called, you know, women going off to marry martyrs and stuff?
Definitely disturbing. I mean, there's no way around it. But what are you going to do? I mean, there are people... The thing is that their concept is that you contribute wherever you can, and, you know, in whatever way that you know how. Unfortunately for women, it always goes back to the issue of, you know, contributing your own bodies, because supposedly these people are deprived of, you know, well, basically sexual pleasures, maybe. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, at the end of the day, what are you going to do about it? It's disturbing. It's disturbing, but it happens.
But does it come out or feed off something that's happening here? That meaning that you already have in Malaysia this idea that Muslim women or women in general have to serve men in as an in auxiliary positions or whatever, and that this is just an extension of this. This is taking the same logic and discourse that occurs here and saying, well, okay, now it's happening in the battlefield, but so that it connects. So people say, yeah, of course, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of women here still, I mean, among conservative Muslims, women, they still see themselves as basically subservient towards men, and their role, I mean, the best role that they can have is actually to serve their husbands the best way that they know how. And as you said, this is just kind of like an extension of what is going on here. You're definitely right about that, I think.
Now, I was just going to add that a lot of the admonishments against them assume that the problem began in Syria, right? No, and assume as if that decisions were made overnight. No. The problem, the deeper cancer has been brewing here for a long time, and that's what we have to look at.
I mean, one of the issues, of course, is that, you know, feminism has been around for a long time. Discussions of this sort, resistance to it, keeps bumping up popular conceptions, maybe less progressive, illiberal, anti-feminist, anti-women types of conceptions, or religious or conservative conceptions, whatever it is. On that battleground, who's winning? I mean, are we looking? I mean, is this just going to be like a protracted war? I mean, have we made any advance in terms of how women themselves see this?
I think we have. It's always going to be an ongoing battle. It's going to be a struggle, definitely, in terms of ideology and everything. But I think there are discourses that are being made, and I think people are starting to see it. Although, having said that, that's a long way to go. Definitely a long way to go from where we are right now.
Simone de Beauvoir, who wrote Second Sex years and years, decades ago, she said, feminism, to a certain extent, yes, you know, there has been improvements to the liberties and the freedoms that women can have, but we haven't taken them. What we have is what patriarchy has allowed us to have.
It was given, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Reza Aslan was on CNN. I think this is fairly recent because I saw it on Facebook feed today. Yes, my source of news. he said, so he was talking about rebuking that Islam condones violence and that a lot of anti-feminist views are sort of promoted by Islam, or is, you know, there's a propensity there. But no. And then he says, oh, but in Indonesia and Malaysia, women are 100% equal to men.
No.
And I'm like, where? Yeah, yeah. What? Yeah, like, no. I mean, very simply, you don't even have to go into, like, you know, night school talk. Who walks down the street and fears getting raped?
Okay, but I want to ask you this, Jolene. I'm trying not to respond to my default modes when it comes to ISIS or the men who have gone off to battle, or the women who have decided to join and do battle as well. I'm trying to start myself from being judgmental. Mm. And I'm trying to say to myself, okay, so you have an educated woman, right? So she's gone through medical school. Let's just accept all these facts, you know, face value. And she's taken herself to the battlefield, right? She continues to write herself into the narrative. She's not invisible.
Yeah.
She's expressing. I come back to that. Can we read this situation? Can we read the Bird of Jenna differently than the narratives that are being supplied to us by the liberal mass media?
This is what I was struggling with before I came on, actually. I told Fuad, like, I'm not sure if I want to discuss this issue by looking at the Bird of Jenna, you know, through the actions of a woman. We are scrutinizing the woman again. You know, in the recent months, who have we looked at in Malaysia? We've looked at Felicia Yap. We've looked at Yuna. We've looked at Melati, who just because she dons a niqab and she's part of DAP, as if there are no other Muslim or Malay members in DAP. But when a woman does it, you know, and because she sort of wears her religion in that sense, and then everyone feels the right to scrutinize and question her decisions. The liberals or the conservatives, everyone. So I mean, I didn't know if I want to do that with Bird or Jenna.
Yeah, I mean, if I may, I think maybe it's because for the Muslims, perhaps, there's a lack of somebody to look up to. So they need somebody to aspire to. That's why you're always looking at female figures and, you know, they're making headlines, basically. And I think largely it's driven by that. And that is why you see that, you know, when we have all these women who are very bold and, you know, basically they're there to state whatever their principles are, then you have people like, oh, you know, you shouldn't look to this woman. It's not because so much that she's, you know, a woman per se that she's criticized. It's because I think we just have a lack of women to look up to, and therefore you kind of latch on to whichever figures that you have, and therefore you bring all the criticism inside there as well.
But on the whole, the discussion is a good thing.
Yeah.
Though I would like to say, not that I condone the humanizing of the extremism in Bird of Jannah. That's all.
Yep.
I think that's a very interesting point, Jolene, because you're right. Sometimes the frenzy carries us away so much that we don't really understand how the discussion is framed, you know. And in particular, because Bird of Jannah laid out her daily life, she became a spectacle, especially for people who wanted to know more about, the life of youth, not just Malaysians in the Islamic State. So you're right, we should footnote that whenever we think of how it is that the question is brought up. Personally, though, when I look at this, you know, I'm trying to be fair to what I'm seeing here. And the truth is, there is a lot to be angry about in the world. And I think if we really pause just to think of all the destruction, all the injustices that we are powerless to do something about, it can really overwhelm us, right? The difference maybe, and I'm just speculating here, between people like us, urban, middle class, privileged enough, and people like Bird of Jannah, is that maybe they're just more sensitive, that the suffering reaches them more, that they want to do something about it, whereas we just bank for better and better days ahead. I don't know.
But we still use the same Instagram filter.
Exactly. Oh. Okay. But we're so similar, but we go different paths.
We're going to come back with more, and not just on the Bird of Jannah. I think we wanted to just use that as a spark, right? Because we could have talked about this several months ago, and it would have been a man who would have been the pretext, the ex-rock star. But he's not so articulate. you know. But anyway, you've been listening to Ong Jolene, Yana Rizal, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutin. This is Night School, BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin, and Night School continues. We're talking about the Bird of Jannah, Islamic State of Syria and the Levant. We're also talking about alienation in Malaysia and travel and adventure in war and beheadings. I think that's going to be new. But joining me in this discussion, of course, is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and our guests, Ong Jolene and Yana Rizal. Jolene is an independent curator, and so you might hear talk about artists as a reference point quite a bit in this discussion. And Yana Rizal is a coordinator with Project Dialogue, and she works with Fuad on that. The mass media has a particular framing. It's got a particular narrative to sell, right? Especially those that are conservative. ISIS is bad. It's not even illiberal. It's barbaric. We recently had the former Prime Minister, Tun Mahathir, weighing in on this issue. We've had the ex-Mufti of Perak, I believe, who's come in to say, well, actually, it's Mahathir. It's your fault, you know? So everybody's blaming everybody else. Instead of kind of looking at the factors, the push factors, right, or the pull factors, which is a kind of sociological trope that's often news. How else can we think about this?
Vice News has a very interesting 5-part documentary on ISIS, and it's really quite eye-opening because it's filmed very Tay style, where they have a journalist following the local legal officers around on a daily basis. And first thing that struck me is that there's a lot of things there that I think ordinary people can relate to. The fact that they go swimming together, the fact that, you know, they have stand-up comedy shows, right? So ISIS actually, once they take over the town, just as a way of introducing themselves, they will have sort of comedy shows, you know?
Oh, you mean they just don't do the beheadings? They also have comedy shows?
Yeah, they do have comedy shows. Yeah,
humor.
But I think this is a very important point. We do not want to make them as some supernatural evil too, because if we really want to understand the phenomena, yeah, right, we must be fair to what it is that's happening.
Yeah, we don't, but you know, a lot of the media does.
No, of course. I'm just referring to that.
Yeah, and because there was that odd thing about them liking Nutella. I think there was this whole thing about
apparently
ISIS.
Pringles and Lays too.
So, okay, this might be because they recruit people from Europe who are kind of used to Nutella and Pringles. So, okay, so there's a complexity in the real organization beyond the demonization of the media that perhaps is part of the attraction of it, right? I mean, do we still need to answer the question about why Malaysians would want to enter this war? Why would you want? Is this like Spain and the Spanish Civil War that drew? You know, it was an ideological battle that drew volunteers from around the world because it's an internationalist type of a war, right?
Orwell, Hemingway.
Yeah,
I mean, Fuad mentioned alienation and isolation back home, and that's why they joined this war that's so far away. But on the other side, I've been also thinking that I think it's just the connectivity of the world we live in and the social media and the internet. Of course, we think of internet and social media. The next word is it's liberalizing, you know. So we think it only belongs to so-called inverted commas us, the liberals. Mm. But it's everyone's, and so they have actually, I wouldn't say they co-opted, but it's out there for everyone to use, and they have. And particularly Bird of Jannah, I think she was a big hit because, like I said, she uses the same Instagram filters that the people who hang out at the B in Publica would. You know, the kind of language that she uses. And she even cracked a couple of jokes there. But of course, you know, she added the word that it's a halal joke. Yeah. So we're not, you know, this whole identity of yourself and the other doesn't really, yeah, it's not that different, like what Fuad was saying. And like, and you said, you know, try to understand them instead of just demonizing them. Like an example was when I went to a museum and there was a particular art piece that quoted one of the leaders who destructed the Bamiyan Buddhas. So everyone would say, yeah, I mean, that's crazy, right? Who would destroy this world heritage? But the explanation we don't get to see usually is that he said people from the West kept coming to ask him, can we come and restore these Buddhas? I want to put money in. I want to come and see this. And no one gave money or a thought about the people who were starving and dying there. So that's just the flip side. Mm.
I don't know if it's so much, I mean, going back on what you said just now, I don't know so much if it's us and them. I think they're very close to us. It's just that you have to realize when these things happen, it's possibly a more extreme manifestation of what is really going on in the ground today, the sentiments that are already here. So I think when we look at this, we have to kind of have, you know, a wake-up call. You know, what is this saying about what we're going to, you know, where we're heading?
You know, I was struck with, I don't know which beheading it was, but it was a beheading in which the executioner said, this is one way we can level up the meaning, the value of life. You know, Muslim lives in the Middle East are worth nothing, he says. And this was saying, well, okay, you know, we asked for 100 million or so for your life from your government. Now you know how much your life is really worth. And it's as worthless as the lives of Muslims in the region. And, you know, coming after the bombing of Gaza, you really do feel, I could empathize. I could say, well, you know, yeah, I mean, you can feel that the lives of Gazans, or whether they're Christian Gazans or Muslim Gazans, whatever it is, are completely worthless in the larger geopolitics of the region. So people are saying, okay, so in some ways, it's these bizarre symbolic gestures. You know, the beheading is not about punishing that person. It's about making that murder, because it's so shocking and you know that the media will pick it up, making that gesture to explain a kind of politics around the world.
I actually want to expand on what Yana said there. I think one of the most banal things that you will encounter in Muslim circles in this country, right, in moderate Malaysia, is an ongoing preoccupation, rhetorically, intellectually, on how un-Islamic the world is. You know, and this can take very mundane forms, right? It's like, the way people are dressing is not Islamic. Oh, our banking system is not very Islamic. Oh, this hotel is not very Islamic. So the idea that the world must be Islamized plants this seed of suspicion among Muslims that the world just isn't Islamic enough. And I think, like Yana said, right, the problem didn't begin in Syria, right? The problem began here. And I wonder sometimes what micro effects this ongoing apprehensions about things never being Islamic enough is happening to people in the level of their everyday thinking and relating to the world, in which case we have these mutations that end up in Syria.
Yeah, I know this idea. I mean, I've been in a supermarket where this young lady, because I had bought beer, okay? So beer doesn't come from the non-halal section of the supermarket. It's in the halal section because it's a can, right? But, you know, she couldn't pick it up. And so she reached for her hijab, the edge of her hijab, to pick up these items. And I wondered about her.
What was she picking up again?
A canned beer.
Okay. So she wore a hijab and she
used the cloth. So the cloth is it kind of interface, right? And I was thinking, the kind of stress that somebody goes through living in a world where you're constantly confronted with things that are polluting. Mm. And of course, pollution type of discourses are there in many traditions. Correct, religious correct. Traditions That's is true. Not, it's not limited to Islam, right? So Hindu and stuff like that. But I was thinking, if I could think sympathetically, the stress that she must go through, having to work in a supermarket, maybe that's, you know, the job that she can get in a very expensive city for her, and having to compromise constantly or put herself in danger of being tainted. Yeah. You know, and I feel for that person, you know.
I think, I mean, going from what you said, I think there's also this propagation of an increasingly more pedantic kind of Islam that is going here. And because of that, you're breeding anxiety into your everyday life. And because of that as well, I mean, anxiety just kind of increases the frustrations that you have. It kind of builds up and it has to manifest somewhere. That is why, you know, you won't be surprised if you see all these kind of overzealousness going on in here, whether it be, you know, in the internet or even like going off to a war, for example. You won't be surprised if these things happen because you are breeding the seeds for it.
But why have the seeds fallen and taken root so much? I mean, maybe we're exaggerating. I mean, how many people from Malaysia have actually gone to Syria, right?
No, but, you know.
Or maybe how many people support them in their
effort? You'd be surprised, actually. The sympathies for the project. Yeah.
In fact, apparently yesterday, somebody was mentioning to me, Merdeka Center actually came up with the research and they did a survey of school kids and what they thought of ISIS. Apparently, they see ISIS as a part of jihad. And that is very worrying to me. You know, if school kids can think that way.
Jolene, I was going to ask you this. Why do you think that a much more liberal conception of the world, of individuals or whatever, isn't taking as much root as we assume it will? Because when we look at, all the things, the wonderful things that the modern world has to offer, why would anybody turn away from it?
Well, the first thing that I was thinking about when Yana and Fuad was talking was actually does anyone here think that this discussion of having, that's going both ways, right? That they're trying, where even the so-called us liberals are trying to define what a moderate Muslim is feeding into the whole cycle. And you're sort of giving power to this this idea that if you're a Muslim, you only have one identity, which is, no other sort of identities, but of course we are everything, right? You know, you could, in associations, you could be a man, you could be a woman, you could be a Malaysian, and everyone is so many things. So is this, do you think, feeding into the whole, and then that's all people preoccupy
you mean
about?
When,
I'm not trying to
mean,
say it's not good to think about one's faith and religion.
You mean when we vilify them, we're already alienating them, we're adding to their level of alienation,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
I mean, why are we so obsessed with who is a moderate Muslim? And then when you see someone who's Muslim but, you know, petting a dog, you share it like 100 times, like, what? Do you think they're not human beings or humane people can't be Muslims? Why are we so shocked?
I think because the fallacy here is that you always have this mainstream narrative that there's only one kind of Muslim, and that is a fallacy that we have here. But, you know, when you go out from Malaysia, for example, you see that even in Indonesia, you have all sorts of Muslims and they do not vilify each other. In fact, I went to Indonesia and one of the religious leaders there actually said to me, like, Islam di Indonesia ini wanawani ya. And he doesn't say it in a negative, with a negative intonation or connotation such.
So this wanawani, does it include people that have gone off to join the battle in Syria and Iraq? I mean, can we can we accept that there will always be people who want to do this, who think that this is how you define your religion or your religious, your faith, your commitment to your religion?
I think if you ask me whether they're still Muslims, the fact that they still believe in Allah and, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, I think they're still Muslims, but I do not condone their actions. I don't think it's right. And, you know, some dialogue needs to happen between us and them in order for us to kind of like maybe come to a middle ground, or, I don't know, pull them back here, or maybe, you know, maybe we can see where they're coming from. But, you know, there are certain principles that you just cannot breach, you know, when we're talking about, you know, human lives and all that. I think that goes with every religion as well. You know?
So, okay, so we have the Warna Warni, the variety, the spectrum, the diversity. But can we take a completely relativist position on the question of the Islamic State and certain practices?
I wouldn't take a relativist position because I wonder, and God forbid, I wonder at which point that God. they might I'm trying to communicate to them, they might bring their adventures here, you know, or they don't, you know, it'll be a long way to come back here. But I mean, like, they don't have to even go there to get to seek their rush, you know. So that's a realistic, I think, possibility given how intense their desires are. I do want to add a bit more a kind of sociological perspective here. I mean, if you look at just the rapidness of modernity itself, right? And Berman talks about this, how we are modern subjects. Most of us and our listeners are middle class. We enter into a narrative of self-empowerment through our careers, through our education, so on and so forth, right? But the world we live in is so far beyond our power to control. The economy is, the fate of the economy is not in our hands. The fate of politics is not in our hands. So there's this paradox between, on one hand, the aspirations for self-fulfillment, on the other hand, an indifferent world, right? And as modernity develops, this becomes more intense, right? And social media adds to that. So my sense is that it's only going to get worse, that we have to get ready for more interestingly outlandish stuff like we're talking about today.
Are we doomed like Faust?
Jolene. So Jolene, you're referring to, okay, we were talking about Marshall Berman's work, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. And of course, Goethe's work is part of that analysis. What is clear is that even if we try to be empathetic towards these people who have gone, that perhaps they will not return the favor, that they probably don't share the same embrace of Varnavarni and relativism or whatever. I mean, relativism maybe is a little more weird. And so the question is, at the end of the day, the democratic state and those who support it will have to somehow define those that are outside its society, those who no longer deserve the protection of a democratic society. I mean, this is maybe the hardest lesson for Democrats to learn, that at some point we need to define an outside to this world that we live in, right? And then the question is, what? Do we then support the, you know, the use of drones and the bombing and all the collateral damage that will go along with the attempt to now decimate, the Islamic State?
But maybe the answer to your earlier question about why this, you know, the liberal world and things we've learned now hasn't taken as much as a foothold we think it would is because of this isolation of modern day life. And for most people, if you put in the class struggle, it's not a walk in the park at all. And in Bird of Jana, I think one of the things she talks about is that being in ISIL, that state, you are free from class struggle. Everyone gets a stipend, everyone is provided food, and everyone are, in inverted commas, equal. Of course, I would question the equality between genders, but that's another topic altogether.
Okay, this is a huge topic, and and we use Bird of Jana as an entry point to it, but there's so much to be discussed, I think. So as a point of reflection, maybe we could make recommendations for books that will help, you know, us to think through this very complex issue. So who would like to start? So Fuad.
I've recommended this before, but for a different discussion, I realize how relevant it is to today's discussion. It's Ahmad Wahib's Pergolakan Pemikiran Islam, which deals particularly with the whole topic of modern alienation, but in a very graceful and patient way. So he really and poetically unpacks all the fundamental questions of faith in a very complex world and through his diaries. So it's very personal, it's very intimate, and it's very moving as well. And it offers a window into the depth of that feeling of not being at home in the world. But it's also beautiful. And I think whenever we want to pass judgment, we should pause to think of the layers of emotions and apprehensions that are happening behind these antagonists that we so often vilify.
So this is an Indonesian Islamic scholar. Is the work translated into English?
No, I actually have the
onerous task.
The only English translation was done by me. It's in the Journal of South Asian Middle Eastern Studies. I can give you a reference for that if you want.
Okay.
But Malay is easy to read too. No, I'm not saying that he is conservative. I'm just saying that he's in fact lumped together with liberals. But he articulates the anxieties which are rarely acknowledged whenever we talk about political Islam in a legal context and stuff like that. Yeah,
Yana, do you have a recommendation?
Well, not me personally, no.
Jolene, do you have a recommendation?
Yes, because we talked about gender and women, I would recommend Silvia Federici. Just put her name in, and if you can, find Caliban and the Witch or Revolution at Point Zero. Or is it Zero Point?
These are novels?
No, they're not novels, nonfiction. And Revolution at Point Zero is a collection of essays, very easy to read.
Okay, well, you know, that also is an echo of that famous novel by the Egyptian Nawal El-Sadawi's Woman at Point Zero. I would like to recommend, just because, you know, Jolene mentioned the whole question of Muslim moderates and that's come up, the work of Mahmoud Mamdani, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, famously married to the Indian filmmaker Meera Naya. So that work actually traces the evolution of a particular discourse about Muslims and its relation to, you know, counterinsurgency, you know, the Contras in Latin America, and all the geopolitical underpinnings of many of these discourses. So I think it's a really worthwhile read, and I think it's available locally. So, okay, so we have those books and suggestions, and maybe, Jolene, you could post some of the images created by the artists that you mentioned in the show today.
Sure.
Wonderful. So you can continue this discussion with us on our Facebook page, BFM Night School. Also, you could write to us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or tweet us. Yana, do you have a Twitter account?
Oh, I tweet for Project Dialogue. Yep. So yeah, our Twitter handle is Project Dialogue. In the Malay spelling, by the way.
Okay, Project with a K.
Yeah.
Jolene, do you have a Twitter account?
Yes, I do. It's my full name, Ong Jolene, at that's the Twitter handle.
Okay, Ong Jolene. And I'm, of course, at Sharad Kutan. And of course, Afuad does not have a Twitter account. He's just missing out on the revolution.
I feel alienated. On
the bird of Jannah might want to tag you on these things. Like,
not just me. I hope everybody else gets tagged as well.
Tag is a gentle, peaceful relationship with people. You know, no blood is spilt when you tag somebody. I understand. Okay, thanks again. You've been listening to Ong Jolene. She's an independent curator. Yana Rizal, who's the coordinator with Project Dialogue. And of course, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. And myself, Sharad Kutan. Thank you all for being here. This has been Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.